the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We've chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
The petrography of Cemetery Rock's Artenikawa's world in relation to projected mining yields with Alex Wells.
I'm Jen.
I'm Paul.
And today we have a super extra special guest, Alex Wells. Welcome, Alec.
Hi. My voice may sound familiar, but I assure you I'm a completely different person. I don't have like a little waxed mustache that I twirl. I'm not from the Mirror Universe.
No relation to Alex Axe. That is also on the Skiffy and Fanti Show. None whatsoever.
None. You can tell the difference because when I'm Alex Wells, I wear glasses. And when I'm Alex Axe, I do not wear glasses.
Ooh, I see. I like it. Do you also wear a cape?
Are phone booths involved?
Maybe. Who can even find a phone booth anymore?
Yeah, that's a good question. Are there even any phone booths in Colorado, much less the world?
I haven't seen one, but... I assume you are always a dapper sir, though.
Yes, always. I sleep like this.
I believe the phrase that was pointed at you at some Worldcon was dapper as fuck. Pardon my language.
Yes, I have been recognized by the chair of WSFIS as dapper AF.
Nice. So a little bit about Alex. You might know them from our Hugo-nominated podcast, Skiffy and Fanti Show.
Yay!
Alex has also had short stories published in Strange Horizons, Lightspeed, Daily Science Fiction, and Shipmer. Correct me if I'm wrong if there's more.
Gigantosaurus.
A new one. Yes, that's right. And you write movie reviews for Mothership Zeta and Strange Horizons. And the most important thing, the reason we are all here, you just had your first novel released. Congratulations.
Yes. Yeah!
Yay! Hunger Makes the Wolf, which was just published by Angry Robot Books. So welcome to the show.
Thanks. I've never been here before, so thank you for welcoming me, human.
You're welcome, citizen.
This is going to be the most professional podcast we have ever done.
I think it could be more professional if Sean was here, and then he and I could, like, get in a fight about comic book movies and Man of Steel.
I think we'll have to save that for another one.
I love you, Sean.
So let's get to the book, which I just read this week.
Because you are good looking and have amazing taste.
Thank you.
And same for Paul.
I was blown away.
I mean, basically everyone who reads my book goes from like, you're a beautiful human being who's already a 10 to like 11 because my book is only read by amazing people and it will make you even more amazing.
It will.
True fact. I'm a scientist. You can trust me.
I devoured it in about 6 hours. It was amazing. I am now throwing it at my children and my husband and beating them with it until they read it.
Well, thank goodness it's a paperback.
But let's begin at the beginning. The main protagonist of Hunger Makes the Wolf, Hop Ravani, didn't have that name in the very beginning. She debuted in the short story Fire in the Belly, which was only published last year, but as I understand, you wrote it a number of years ago. So I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit about that story and how it came to be a novel as opposed to, say, a recurring place or character in additional short stories. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the process of developing a novel from a short story.
So, yeah, the short story Fire in the Belly I wrote years and years ago on one of the few writing retreats I've ever been on. Because, well, actually, hilariously, if memory is serving, because, you know, God, it was so long ago, I've aged 90 years in the last month and a half, so it was like centuries ago. I actually wrote the first story that I got professionally published in Beneath Ceaseless Skies, which is the Book of Autumn. I actually sat down and I wrote that story at the retreat first because I really wanted to write the story about Hob, and the Book of Autumn would not leave me alone. So I wrote that first so I could clear it out of my brain and actually write the story that I wanted to write about this girl who gets tricked into going into the desert by this evil old shitbag of a man named Old Nick. And I wrote it and everyone at the retreat loved it. And then I spent the next several years trying to get it published until Mothership Zeta finally, like, I guess, kind of got what I was doing and bought it. And I went back to that retreat a little bit later and I wrote another story about Hob, who was now named Hob. She started out as a little girl named Henrietta who jumped ship on that planet. And so I wrote like another thing where I was like, oh, okay, so I've got this idea for, like, you know, now that she's in the Ghost Wolves, this is a thing that she goes and does. And it was actually the first story that the Bone Collector was in. And I read that to everyone at the end of the retreat, and everyone was like, well, this is really cool, but you realize it's not actually a short story. It's the chapter of a novel, and I think you need to just keep writing more chapters. And that is this perennial problem that I have trying to write short stories, because I made the mistake. Well, I don't even say it's necessarily a mistake for me, because it's gotten me where I am. And obviously, like, I just had a book published and I'm super happy about it. So I don't have anything to complain about. But I took the old school, not really applicable any longer advice about, oh, you need to start writing short stories and then you can somehow, like, build up enough street cred that agents will, like, dive down your chimney like ninja and want to sign you on, which is not how it actually works. Or at least not if you're me, because I actually am not very good at writing short stories, and it became, like, this point of honor where I was like, I'm gonna fucking write short stories until I don't suck at them. And I'm still trying for that. But, like, because my preferred, like, the format of my heart is, like, novella and novel, so much of what I write that I want to be a short story is like, no, this is the chapter of a much longer story that I find more interesting. And that's actually just how Hunger Makes the Wolf came to be, where I was like, oh, but there's more things I can tell you about Hob, and they're not actually short stories, they're just chapters, so I'm gonna write an entire fucking book, fine.
That makes sense. I was actually pleasantly surprised that I thought it was going to be a slightly shorter novel. It comes in as a whopping, like, what, 452 pages. It's a sizable book. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think word count wise, it's like 115,000, which is pretty up there for particularly science fiction. Like, fantasy, they let you get away with it being a little longer, like up to 120,000, to make room for, like, your bullshit secondary fantasy world building.
Hey, now.
Hey, I'm, you know, Hunger Makes the Wolf came in kind of long, because honestly, when you look at it, I world built it like it was a bullshit secondary fantasy world.
Yes, and I do want to talk to you about that.
Oh dear, am I in trouble?
No, you're not in trouble. Feature, not bug.
Yay!
Before we get there, I wanted to expand a little bit further on the question. So you have this story that really is a chapter of a novel. So actually, how do you go about building out of that short story? How do you world build out of a story into a novel as far as the characters, the world, and just the whole writing process? How do you make that work?
I mean, part of it is this question is actually kind of difficult to answer because I did the bulk of the writing on this, you know, the original rough draft. I finished it in, I want to say, 2011. So this is like ancient history for someone who has a goldfish memory like me. And I mean, I remembered that I had a really clear idea about Hob and what I wanted her to do and Old Nick, and I sat down and I really thought out Tanagawa's world. Like, that, I know how that world, it functions entirely, even if I haven't told you a lot about it, you know, and you get to find out more in the next book. Next book!
Oh, good!
You know, and like, the Bone Collector, they were all, like, these characters that I initially thought up, and then I was like, okay, how can I expand them out to be kind of fully realized people that have histories and have wants and places they're going and personalities. And then, I mean, the other thing about this book in particular is the rough draft was about as long as this book, but had 35,000 words on the front that started with Fire in the Belly, with that short, you know, what became that short story, and goes all the way up through where Hob makes her really big, awful mistake that I'm not going to spoil right here. And then we launch into the next part, which is actually the first chapter of the current book. So, yeah, when I actually submitted it, oh God, no. I want to say, yeah, it was actually, I hired Molly Tanzer to edit it because I was like, okay, I want to try to do some unsolicited submissions. This needs to be perfect. And we had a long talk about, like, you know, all this stuff at the beginning is really important because it explains basically everything you need to know about Hob and the psychotic old shitbag that raised her. But it also feels like the story doesn't actually even start until like 36,000 words in, and that's a problem. And I ended up just taking that entire chunk and cutting it off. And then, you know, just sort of like taking the really important parts of that and you know, filing them in where you needed to know or where they needed to come out to build into the story and explain like what's going on between Hob and Mag. But so there's just a lot of writing in this that you didn't even get to see. And then beyond that, like when I was plotting out the part that actually became this book, I sat down and I outlined it. And I mean, I didn't outline it quite as psychotically as I outlined the sequel, but I did a very detailed outline to figure out how all the plot fit together. And then I just wrote to the outline because I was like, now that I have set up this situation, what are the logical consequences of these certain events happening that are not in anyone's control, and how are these wildly different people going to react to it? And like, you know, some of it, like Shige was not actually supposed to be that important of a character. He just kind of like showed up because I needed someone to be able to tell Hob some shit she needed to know, and no one that was actually in the company was going to do it. And then he just kind of took on a life of my own. And then I wrote like, you know, 5 different drafts of the outline to be like, okay, now what's Shige doing? All right, motherfucker. All right, here we go. So that was kind of the process. It was a really messy process.
I love that it was messy.
Oh, it was so messy.
I think that will give a lot of writers hope. Like, okay, it's supposed to be messy. We're good. We got this.
Yeah. I mean, like, compared to like, that book, that this, you know, sequel is like a fucking well-oiled machine. But you also, hi, baby writers, I'm talking directly to you. I also want you to realize that Hunger Makes the Wolf is like the fifth novel that I've written. And that's not even counting like all the shit that I wrote as fan fiction that was novel length. It's just, this is the first one that's actually been good enough to publish.
To write, writers must write.
Exactly.
So you mentioned Hob and Mag. So I'm going to riff off that really quickly, because this story is about both of them. It's not just Hob. It's definitely Mag and her role as eventually the union organizer, which I just found fascinating. And, you know, it's like, what's the word for a female bromance? Because I need that word. Does that word exist?
Maybe in German.
I was going to say, I think it's called friendship. When I'm not afraid of my masculinity being threatened because I'm a woman, I think that's the word for it.
Friendship. Oh, that's what that is. It's so rare to see in a book where the antagonism is thrown out. I mean, you have a little bit right at the beginning, but it's not the important part of their relationship. These are two perfectly functioning adult women who have a friendship. It was really nice to see. Can you explain how Mag came about in sort of opposition to Hob?
So when I was writing that lost 35,000 words, I was like, okay, this book is full of boys. And this is something that now, like, future me looks at past me and is like, oh, well, you know, if I was writing this book today, there are a few things that I would do differently. But I was like, Hob needs a friend who isn't a boy. Because all of the boys in her life are dumb. And so...
Frecky and Jerry?
Yeah. Well, Frecky's okay. Jerry's an asshole.
I actually love both of them, so no killing. Please continue. Sorry.
So I was like, how is Hob going to have a friend? Because old Nick is not running like a fucking kindergarten on his base. I can't just like invent another little girl on the base that Hob could be friends with and like learn how to human from. I was like, oh, all right. So why don't they go into town and visit old Nick's brother? And he's got a daughter, because that actually makes sense with their ages. And then Mag kind of grew to be this person that would balance Hob and be her opposite in a lot of ways.
Yeah, she was an interesting contrast.
Yeah, where it's like when Hob's mad about something, Mag is calm, and when Mag's mad about something, Hob is calm, and they just bolster each other and support each other. And I mean, like in the beginning section, Mag teaches Hob how to sew, and Hob teaches her how to like punch people in the throat, and it's really cute. They're like little murder friends, and I love them so much. And a lot of it was influenced because my best friend that I made in college, that I mean, she lives in Colorado, she and I see her all the time still, and like we hang out and she's my best friend. I mean, in a lot of ways she is very, very different from me. And that means when there is something where I'm just like, oh, I can't handle this and my head is exploding, like, she has it handled. Those kind of friendships really, really work out well, and we don't get to see them that often, despite the fact that they're often a factor of our everyday lives.
Right. It was nice to see them not in competition.
Yeah, because, well, I've noticed, like, especially in movies, like, the only time you see women as friends, then there's, like, the boy that they both want. Just, you know, fuck that. That's not how it works.
I think you are our most sweariest author that we've had on so far, and I'm loving it.
I feel like it's appropriate considering the book.
It absolutely is. So Mag and Hob, they make sense. And I think the nice thing about Mag is that she gives you the glimpse into one of the really important facets of this book, which is the union organization against the company, Transrift, which controls the planet. Thing. I've seen a lot of people describing this as Dune-like, and then other people going, no, it's Firefly. And I'm like, well, it's kind of a bit of both. It's like Firefly if it had taken place prior to the war. Because we're actually getting to see how people on the ground live and exist within this, you know, corporate-controlled environment. So how did that become such a major factor?
So the reason I ended up going with this plot line about unionizing is that, well, I mean, there's a couple things. Okay, I grew up in a union household. My dad was the chief steward for the CWA Local 7750. So, and we went through one major strike. And I really remember a lot of that from my childhood and kind of how important it was and why the workers were on strike. And so, you know, that came in from an early age. And then the first 6 years of being an adult, I worked at AT&T like my dad had, and I was a part of the CWA. And there was a lot about that job that didn't work out, but being a union member was actually really amazing because you knew that no matter what, the union had your back. Like, if the bosses tried to fuck with you, you'd always have somebody there on your side, and it would keep them from, you know, pulling some shit that's very untoward. And as I moved out in my career and I was no longer in a union shop anymore, I started really seeing the value in that to me personally. And, you know, also seeing like how unions have been forcibly beaten down by corporate interests using legal methods. And, you know, often illegal methods that then become legal because who's got the money? So what I really wanted to do was try to explain to people who have probably gone their entire lives without ever being in a union why unions are important and why you would even want to be in a union and why it's not great that unions have been further and further diminished. And then the other thing I did a bunch of research about Colorado history and about the Colorado Coalfield Wars in 1913 and 1914, which ended with the massacre at Ludlow, because I think that's labor history that you hear a little bit about if you live in Colorado, maybe. And I don't even remember if I learned about it in school. I know I learned about it because my dad was in the union, but the massacre at Ludlow happened because the coal miners were on strike, and the corporate bosses convinced the governor to send in the Colorado National Guard, and things went very badly, and women and children got killed. So it's like this entire history that we're losing. And when I looked at the setup that I had on the planet, where it's like, you know, it's basically the entire world is owned by a company, the government has no way of coming in if they even really care, which, you know, there can be discussion about that. But it's basically a massive company town. And at the time that I was writing it, I'd been seeing just like so much bullshit about, like, you know, well, you can't expect companies to be good because they're not people. And, you know, people talking down about like work, you know, working class stuff, about like fast food workers and all that who wanted to start trying to unionize. And I was just like, fuck it, I'm going to write about somebody who is in this situation, who has no choice but to seek collective action, because that is what a single person is not very loud, but when everybody speaks together, that's when people have power.
Right, and literally they have no choice. I'm not going to spoil why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's always a choice. I guess they could just, like, go, like, you know, fucking die in mining accidents and ineffectually complain about it, but it's not much of a life.
That's not much of a choice.
No. It's a shitty choice, just like there are a lot of, you know, in our reality, like, so most stories have a basis in reality. There are a lot of people that don't have a lot of choices right now.
Or they're being taken away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had not made the connection that Ludlow on this planet was clearly named after Ludlow in Colorado.
I mean, all the mining towns in this book are named after coal mining towns in Colorado that were in some way involved in the Coalfield Wars.
I did not know that. That's interesting. I thought you had just invented the names.
Nope.
So they all are. Huh. Interesting.
What about the farming towns?
So the farming towns I did kind of just make up.
Okay, just checking. Because I was sitting there Googling them like, I can't find Blessed.
Yeah, no, I think I got the town name for Blessed from something.
It sounds very Utah-like.
Yeah, but I mean that, like, the farming communities are kind of like their own can of worms.
Well, yeah, and you make that point in the book that, yeah, the farming towns and the mining towns should work together, but they're kind of very wary of each other for... And the company likes it that way.
Yeah, the company sets them in opposition to each other because that makes them easier to control.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that was kind of interesting because, you know, this is basically a company-controlled mining town writ large, right? But the one thing that I didn't notice, at least explicitly, was the idea of the company store.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though, in hindsight, that's clearly the reality that they're living under, they seem to have more options than a small mining town might have had.
Yeah, and a lot of that is kind of, you know, like contraband trading with the farming towns, because, and, you know, like cottage industries, like, that I was actually thinking about because of, God, when I took pre-modern Japanese history, and they were talking about cottage industries that the peasants participated in, and how a lot of them made, like, a really good living on, like, okay, you know, you'd go tend your fields, and then you'd be like having brackish water pools that you would slowly render down to get salt, and then you'd sell the salt. So, like, in that way, because their world is not quite as circumscribed as a single town, and they've been there long enough to have families and to actually, you know, have people that aren't just mining or farming or whatever, you know, you can get a little more variation in their industry, but, you know, then shit's going to get real in the next book, so.
Yeah, and there's something I want to mention. I don't want to spoil it, so I don't want to mention. But there's definitely an aspect to this world that, yeah, puts an interesting twist on having the farming towns and the mining towns under, and them trying to live together on this planet, on a planet that's ruled by a corporation and a corporation that rules hyperspace, basically. That's a lot of power.
Yeah. I kind of imagine, like, oh, somebody being like, well, why doesn't the government come in and be like, hey, stop killing your miners and mine accidents? And I'm like, because the government has no options either. You can either have interstellar travel and do whatever Transrift wants, or you can sit on your fucking planet and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of Dune 2, just like Jen's, like, Spacers Guild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, monopolies aren't good.
Yeah, monopolies are not good. So I actually want to talk about the other side of the characters. You mentioned Shige before, but I want to talk about how you came up with our primary antagonist, Miss Meacham.
Okay, so I'll admit this right off. Like, when I originally wrote this book, I mean, it was, like, the book is already super dude heavy. It was even more dude heavy. And Miss Meacham started out as a dude. And then, you know, when I was looking at it, I was just kind of like doing the thing where I was going, all right, what of these characters, like, is there anything intrinsic in Meacham's character that says Meacham has to be male or female? And I didn't really find anything in there. And I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to rewrite. And I really didn't have to rewrite that much because evil managerial shitbaggery does not change that much between genders, and in the future, I doubt it will change at all. So then Meacham became Ms. Meacham. And in a way, I feel like I should, like, send a thank you note or something to the current administration, because no matter how much mustache-twirling evil the corporate bosses through Meacham do at this point, it's going to sound pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
I shouldn't laugh, but yeah.
And the other thing, like, what I based a lot of her attitude off of, though I tried to make it slightly more subtle because that was, you know, I submitted it before all of this happened when it would have sounded unreasonable. So I tried to tone it down a little, is I just looked at, like, say, during the last Gilded Age, how corporate owners talked about their workers. And, you know, it really was shit like, oh, well, they should be grateful that I'm paying them slave wages to die of black lung because, you know, otherwise they're just, like, worthless street scum. You know, I'm giving them the opportunity to learn the value of hard work and the dignity. And, well, I mean, gosh, if I paid them more, it would just hurt the dignity that they're earning with all this hard work. I mean, like, shit like that. I mean, it is stuff that when you read it now, it does sound like, you know, like, cartoonishly villainous. And apparently we're moving back into that. So, okay, you know, thanks.
Gilded Age 2.0.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, she is supposed to represent, like, a very kind of Gilded Age attitude of managers to workers. Particularly when you consider that these are people that are entirely within their power and have no recourse.
And she still sounds more competent and interested in the results than the current administration, which is kind of depressing.
Well, I mean, she is very results-driven. Like, if she was in charge of our government, it would be terrible to anyone who wasn't a billionaire, but at least things would get done.
The trains would run, to use the metaphor.
Yeah, basically. Which is just awful.
Now I'm depressed.
You're welcome.
Okay, I will escape on depression by talking about going into world building and jumping out of villainy and stuff entirely. So I read lots of books for world building. That's why I started reading books for, be it science fiction or fantasy. So when I was reading this book, yeah, I was thinking in terms of how you're building this world. So do you have Hal Clement Poole Anderson style notes on the solar system? Do you know the semi-major axis of Tenengauer's world and the luminosity of the star?
No. So it's weird that, like, as absolutely anal retentive as I am about plot structure, I'm really not like that about my world building. I'm just like, yeah, you know, it's like a planet and there's some sand and the I know what the geology is like entirely.
Right. I was like, you're lying to us right now because I know you know exactly what's going on geologically on that planet.
Oh, yeah, I totally know what's going on geologically. I just haven't really written it down anywhere because it's all in my head. So if you cut my head off, then you can like shake it out. But like if you asked me how many planets were in that system, I couldn't even tell you.
I want to know these things. This is what I jam on.
I do have to say that I think this is the first time that I've ever heard the term hardpan used in a book.
Hardpan, dunes. There's lots of desert geology in this book, and I geeked out on it. They're like, oh my god, people reading this book will understand that desert's not just sand dunes. Bless you, Alex. Bless you.
Oh yeah, that's because deserts are like my favorite land forms. And, you know, also, okay, so when I was writing the book, that was when I was doing my structural field geology course, and we did 2 trips down to Moab. So I got to really kind of experience firsthand, like, a lot of other desert landforms and, you know, things like desert crust and, you know, and then you get the places where there's hardpan and it, you know, and it's not something I could curse myself for not mentioning, but, you know, there's you get like a patina on things. It's just, it's really cool. And that stuff I all have I have a really good idea about. I think it's because when I was writing, I was like, I need to know how all this is put together so that I can interact with it. So like, if they say left the planet, then I would sit down and be like, all right, I need to figure out like about the star and how many planets there are and, you know, other shit like that. Cause then it will actually, you know, need to be mentioned as a setting detail. But if I don't need to get into that level of detail, I tend to just be like, oh, you know, it's kind of like out there and, it, you know, there's stuff. There's a star. It's presumably kind of yellowish because I'm not that creative.
Oh, that's hilarious. So speaking of the geology, okay, maybe this isn't, you know, related in any way, shape, or form, but it is because the Bone Collector.
Yes.
Is one of our ins to the geology of this planet. Quite literally. I really liked the touch of the sand. In the one scene.
Excellent.
No spoilers. Try not to spoil anything.
Yeah, we're trying desperately, listeners.
Sand's important.
Sand is super important.
But, okay, so the Bone Collector, I've decided he's super sexy because I ship him with myself.
So wait, I want to know, like, in your head, who he looked like.
I didn't have a particular look, but somebody posted a picture of a model today. I think you actually retweeted it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I think he looks like him. I've decided he looks like him just because I want him to look like him.
I could totally go for that. I mean, I think when I was writing him, I was thinking kind of like David Bowie in Labyrinth because, of you know, if there's going to be anyone that's like weird and mysterious, he's going to be David Bowie, but...
No, I love the Bone Collector. And I think the reason I was like, oh, he has to be hot, was because you don't actually ever explicitly describe him beyond kind of what he's wearing.
Oh, God, that's true. You're right. Because the description of him was in the chapter that got cut out.
Oh, that explains it.
That's fine. I mean, like, there's a good description of him, but it all has to do with those parts of him that are important to the story, like his sign of role, his witchiness, if you will. So, but I was like, dude, this guy has to be hot. He is, because he's so awesome.
Oh, he's super hot.
I just want to ship him with someone, anyone.
Mostly yourself.
Mostly myself. But tell me about the Bone Collector. Like, what to you is the role that he plays within the narrative?
Well, I mean, so, okay. If I put Shige in there so that there could be someone who could tell Hob facts that were actually useful, the Bone Collector was somebody who could tell Hob a lot of information that has a lot of meaning to him, but is almost completely useless to her.
Now everything makes sense.
So in a way, he's almost like the Ambassador Kosh of... Hunger Makes the Wolf.
Oh my god. I love it.
And I mean, that's actually why there is a scene of her punching him in the face.
Oh, it's amazing.
Because I love that character so much. And I love the fact that he is like composed of rocks and mystic bullshit, but I've always wanted to punch characters like him in the face. And in that moment, Hob was all of us. Like, haven't you ever, like, rewatching Babylon 5 and you just want to grab Kosh by the encounter suit and just be like, say what you fucking mean?
Well, I am rewatching Babylon 5 with Sean and Mike Underwood. Listeners, we have podcasts in our feed about that. So, yes.
They're fun podcasts.
Shameless plug. So, yes. It's like, Kosh, actually be clear for a change. Stop talking riddles.
Yeah, and you spend all this time going like, why is he being this obtuse? Is like, you know, it would be so much more useful if he'd just be like, yo, Sheridan, go and do this thing. And then the thing would happen. And I'm just like, I don't know if Kosh is just an asshole or if it's just that he thinks on a level that humans can't understand. And I'm kind of like, not sure. And that's odds of the Bone Collector.
Right. I love that the Bone Collector is a bit of both. Like, he's clearly just being an asshole at points.
Yes.
Straight up, I'm telling you a riddle because I'm an asshole, and I can, and you can't do anything about it.
I'm doing this just because I know it makes you mad.
His stuff with the blood, yes.
But he's also working on a geological time frame of sorts, so...
Yeah.
But he's also an asshole, so...
Oh, he's a total, I mean, I was actually talking with my agent because he's got another book of mine that is a completely, you know, it's an actual fantasy book, but I was just kind of talking to him about the comparison where I'm like, you know, like everyone in this fantasy book, they're all actually really good people. And then I look at Hunger Makes the Wolf and I'm like, oh my God, I like, they're all super interesting to read and write about, but I would not want to be friends with any of these people in real life. They're all fucking awful.
Except your cook. What's the cook's name?
Oh, Lobo? Lobo's fun.
Yeah, I like Lobo.
I mean, like, even Mag. Mag seems really nice. Mag is not nice.
I would not want to run into Mag in a dark alley.
No.
Especially after a heated meeting.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically every character in this book is just, like, an awful person.
Well, I can understand Shige a little bit because I might be spoiling. Okay, stop. I can't say that. No,
don't spoil anything.
I'm not spoiling. So yeah, let me unwind that. So I actually want to jump in the Bone Collector and because you mentioned your fantasy novel too, the fact that although you might have a science fictional explanation for it somewhere in your brain, at least in this book, witchiness comes across as a fantasy element in a science fiction novel, so why mix the peanut butter and chocolate, besides the fact that they taste great together?
They do taste great together, and I blame Star Wars. I learned it by watching Star Wars. There is actually a reason for it. I am not going to claim it is a reason that has any relation to anything that could be recognized as hard sci-fi, but there is actually a reason for everything that's happening. And I mean, the planet is just full of massive hand-wavium deposits, basically.
Well, yeah. Very early on, we see some of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hand-wavium.
It is the universe's only source of hand-wavium, and then you use the hand-wavium to open rifts that your ships can travel through, thus enabling interstellar travel.
Oh my goodness. I love that you just admit to that. That makes me feel much better.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, there is an excuse for it, but I have no problem admitting that if you were like, well, how does this work with physics? I'd be like, you know, I only took 2 semesters of physics and I really didn't enjoy it, so I don't want to write about it.
Also, biology, you know?
Yeah.
It just happens.
Yeah, it's a thing. Hand-wavium. But I swear to God, there is actually an explanation that will hopefully not get me killed, at the very least.
In book 2, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
That's also where you find out all of the secrets about the Bone Collector, book 2.
I'm stressing out a lot about book 2, because there's a lot that I think is going to happen. So everybody has to read this book just so you can all be like, oh my God, things are going to happen in book 2.
The shit is going to hit the fan.
Things get real.
Shit goes down.
Going back to this book again, one of the other things I want to talk about about this book to you about is the action beats. So stuff does happen. Lots of stuff happened. I mean, you throw Hobbit, you have Hob as a rising through the ranks of a mercenary outlaw biker gang, and it's not like they sit around drinking tea and having knitting circles.
Oh no!
Well, they also do that.
Well, yeah, you know, Lobo leads them. I don't know if you guys caught the character of Hattie, the guy who runs the garage, is a frustrated novelist.
Yes, I saw that. That was amazing. Nice touch. Nice touch.
But yeah, I mean, you know, if they're a mercenary biker gang, they have the only way they can survive is by getting money or getting trade goods for doing things. So they actually have to do things, and you know, or steal. But I mean, I wanted to try to keep the action, like, moving, because I wanted to write, like, a gonzo book.
And you really do. I mean, I don't want to spoil it for the readers too much, but you have lots of set pieces in this book. I kept thinking, I mean, given there was also a desert, badlands landscape with evil corporations and others, I kept thinking, oh my god, this would be a great setting for an apocalypse world role-playing game.
Ooh. I like how you think. I would totally be up for this. Somebody contact me.
I'd play that. I mean, there is a reason that I was like, no, this is Firefly, but before the war takes place, right? You know, like, there's a ton that can happen leading up to that war. And in the TV series, we never got to read about the people on the ground. You know, yeah. Like, what were they doing before they revolted? There had to have been something that led them to that place. It was really nice getting to see things on the ground. One of those things is probably my favorite scene, and I think a lot of other people will agree, which is the great train robbery.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And I will admit right now, okay, you know, Firefly definitely had an influence on this. It's hard to say how much because I wrote it really long ago, but I can tell you that the reason there is a train job is because of Firefly. Because I wanted to do a train job. And I was just like, oh, here's a good reason to do it. Train job. Let's go. And let's have Coyote in on it because I fucking love Coyote.
Oh, Coyote.
Oh, Coyote.
Oh.
There's absolutely no reason they're making sounds like this, people. Don't worry. He's fine. Totally fine. Everything is okay.
I'm literally like holding my tongue in my mouth. But as Paul says, I mean, it's a pretty quick moving novel. And you say it's 115,000 pages. It never.
I mean, 115,000 words. It is not a George R. R. Martin novel.
It comes at 115,000 words, as you said, but it is a quick novel. I don't think there was any point that I was like, okay, I'm bored. Moving on to the next section. So kudos.
Excellent.
But like, we call it the Great Train Robbery. It's not actually a long scene because it doesn't need to be, for one thing. Your action is, it's quick. It's on point. It's like you get it, you do it, and then you move on to the next piece. So tell us about that gonzo action.
Yeah, and how you write it with such economy, because there's something very, very late in the book that's like, wait, that was that? Wow, bang. I don't want to give it away, but you know, I know Alex knows what I'm talking about. It's like, okay, wow.
I think it's because, like, a lot of it is in the editing because I actually tend to overwrite really, really badly and then I edit it down. But I also, like, you know, when I was writing those steampunk mystery novellas before, like, I like having action and I like describing action. As a reader, I really don't like it when action is, like, over-described, where it's like, and then his hand, like, was here, and then it moved here, and then, you know, I'm just like, I don't fucking care, just tell me that he punched someone. It's fine. Like, I want action to read like it's moving fast, because particularly when it's like a fight, fights don't really last that long. It's a very immediate thing that doesn't involve a lot of long, drawn out navel gazing. It's just, you know, things need to happen in a very compact space, because otherwise it just, I don't know, to me it feels like I'm just sort of like writing words to like you know, fluff things out, and they shouldn't be fluffed out. It needs to feel real. It needs to feel really immediate and really, you know, like, here, 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 and then we're done, because it would not reasonably be like, 8 hours later, they're still on the train and having a picnic. And then they kill their 30th guard, and, you know, like... So, I mean, I hope that answers the question. Like, it's not, like, necessarily a conscious choice. Just, I've got how, like, I read stuff that I don't like, and I read stuff that I like, and I try to write more, like, the stuff that I like.
So what do you like to read? What are your inspirations? What do you channel? What do you filter from your reading experience into your writing, be it action scenes, world building, or anything else?
So my favorite books that I feel like, if I wanted to emulate anybody's writing, are like Anne Leckie's books, or Lois McMaster Bujold, or N.K. Jemisin. She is like a goddess, and I just want to sit at her feet and try to absorb a little bit of her awesomeness. And, you know, all of them, particularly Anne Leckie and N.K. Jemisin, have like an economy of word that actually gives what they write more impact. Like, you don't need to belabor the point. You just put it out there, and it hits like a good solid punch, and you don't need more than that. So that, I mean, if I was going to write like anyone, I want to be influenced by them, and I read all their stuff. Like, oh my God, you know, I listen to Lois McMaster Bujold's audiobooks to help me sleep. Not that they're boring, but it's like a comfort thing.
It's also, Grover Gardner's narration really brings those alive.
Oh my God,
yeah.
I love that man. But I guess like the other thing that particularly does influence me for how I write action is actually movies and screenwriting. Because I did actually go through a screenwriting course, and I think, intentionally or not, that's really started to influence how I write. You don't see it, you're not going to see it as much in this book. Probably you're going to see it in the next book with how I structured it and everything, because I fucking outlined it like I'd outline a screenplay. And I can think of big budget sci-fi movies with lots of explosions that bored me to tears, because the action wasn't immediate and there weren't stakes and there wasn't like good emotion in it, and it went on forever because you were like, you can tell they're just like, well, we've got a special effects budget, let's blow it here. As opposed to movies that really like get to the point and they're punchy, and even when it's a set piece, it doesn't feel long. Even when it's one that will sometimes go for a while, good ones don't feel really long because they're paced really well. They're not drawn out for no reason. And I kind of try to, I think I'm trying to emulate that too, where I'm like, there's no reason to necessarily make this any longer. It's as long as it needs to be. Yeah. It's hard to talk about stuff like that for writing process, because when you're writing, you're not like consciously thinking about stuff. You're just like, well, and then a bunch of shit happens and I'll fucking edit this later so that it makes sense. I'm demystifying the writing process.
That's half the reason I wanted you on. So Paul mentioned one of the antagonists, but I think I have to mention the weatherman in the room.
I'm wondering if we were going to get to him.
Mr. Green.
Yes, Mr. Green.
Is that a Firefly allusion to the Blue Ben?
Not consciously, but I think I was kind of going for the creepy vibe.
Oh, I think you got there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, so when I initially submitted this, and then I had an editing phone call with Phil Jordan, and he went over a bunch of stuff with me, and then I went and rewrote some stuff. And there's actually, like, some of the stuff with Mr. Green is sort of additional, because I added it in because I wanted to emphasize some things, and Phil's reaction was like, this is really fucking gross. And I was like, yes! That's what I wanted!
He isn't actually even the creepiest character. He's one of them, I think.
Oh, who do you think is creepiest? I want to know.
Mr. Franklin.
Oh yeah, Mr. Franklin's fucking creepy because he could because he exists in reality, basically.
Yeah,
right, exactly. It was. Yeah. Oh, that was it was nice to see both types of creepy, and almost right next to each other. I mean, they kind of come to a head at the same time. I mean, I did text and tweet to you saying, you know, oh my god, this page. and then it kept going. And I was like, I need this to stop.
Yeah.
And one of those pages is about Mr. Franklin and how the company is protecting people like him.
Enabling him.
So yeah, why put him in there?
Okay, so now we're going to talk about Mr. Franklin rather than Mr. Green.
Do both. Just tell us about both at the same time.
Okay. Well, I mean, Mr. Franklin, in a way, is actually easier to explain than Mr. Green, because I very deliberately put Mr. Franklin in, because, again, when you're on, the workers on this planet are basically held captive, and they have no legal recourse for anything that's done to them, and, you know, this is something that you read about in documentation from, you know, workers during the Gilded Age and during the unionization era, and part of what drove them was that the company could act with such impunity. You know, like, if you had a bad boss, he could just basically do whatever the fuck he wanted, and if you complained about it, you'd get thrown out. And on Tanigawa's world, if you get blacklisted from the mine, you literally have nowhere else you can go. So it's basically a death sentence, even if they're too polite to call it that, you know, to salve their own consciences. So Mr. Franklin really is an artifact of that age, where he's somebody who assaults vulnerable people, you know, women and girls. And because he's a good worker, you know, he's a very good train conductor. The bosses are going to look the other way because they don't give a shit what he does. And, you know, I kind of pulled him directly out of there, but at the same time, it's not like that shit doesn't happen today. And that is really the thing that should be most disturbing about Mr. Franklin is when you look at him and you look at, say, companies where there is no union and there are no strong labor laws in the state, and people basically do not have recourse to deal with even assaults because they need that job. And if they report that, they're going to get fired. It's villains like that exist. They're fucking awful people who enact their villainy through the permissiveness of society, through society's willingness to look the other way. And Mr. Franklin's really fucking awful, and I hate him, and I am glad about how he ends up.
Yep, spoilers.
Yeah, spoilers. And then, I mean, Mr. Green, like, Mr. Green is kind of an entirely different thing, where, like, you know, Mr. Green is only exists because we're in the science fiction fantasy world, and I wanted to come up with some creepy shit in conjunction with the fact that they do have interstellar travel, because, you know, I think you get the impression that Mr. Green is not a normal person.
That's what I was mentioning before with Spacer Guild, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Green was not born of woman. So it's, you know, in a way he is a villain, and in a way he is what he was made to be, and he's another cog in the machine. Where it's basically like, you need somebody to run your ship, so you will create someone who can run your ship and do what they're told. And the side effects, you know, might be a little weird, but the ships run on time, it's fine. So that's really what Mr. Green comes from, is, again, like that idea of a corporation that's completely, that answers to no one, so they can effectively do anything that they want. So, of course, when it's in their economic interest to do, like, some really fucked up stuff, they'll tell themselves a story where that's okay, and the results are not going to be pretty.
Yeah, now you got me thinking of the Dutch East India Company, where they were expanding the reach of British influence, where the British Navy wasn't yet, but they were basically, in effect, the government and doing some very horrible things to local populations, because they could, in the name of money.
Uh-huh. That is another, like, really good historical example to draw on. Like, it's not good stuff.
To me, one of the most fascinating things that you did was describe how the company conducted itself in the witch hunt.
Mm.
In terms of using the local population to police themselves.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's another thing where it's kind of like you have multiple avenues of control to maintain your handle on the populace. You've got the green bellies, you've got, you know, your private security firm who are just awful. You have the threat of blacklisting and all those attendant things. You've got, you know, holding people's paychecks captive and all that. And then what they've basically invented is a method of turning the people against each other. Because this existence of witchiness, where it's basically, you know, like, kind of like Marvel Mutants, where it's like people who can do some weird shit, is guaranteed to stand out to people and to be a little weird and frightening and be like, ooh, you're different. Which then makes it very easy to turn people against each other. And if your population is too busy policing themselves and being divided amongst themselves, that makes them easier to control.
Climate of fear.
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't get to go into this, but like historically for the world, there were some times where you had somebody who had witch powers and things went really freaking badly. But it's mostly just people overreacting and getting manipulated into overreacting. And I mean, when for the interview questions that Elise wrote to me for Shimmer, she mentioned, like, you know, you've got the people that have witch powers, and, you know, is that an intentional allegory for like any particular group? And it's not. I think you could broadly interpret it as that. I mean, I think it's maybe more of an allegory for the ways that people in power turn populations against each other. But it's definitely not a good allegory for any, like, actual marginalized group that exists, for kind of the same reason that werewolves are not a good allegory for any marginalized group that exists, because people who have witch powers, some of them do have powers that could be destructive or hurtful or whatever, and that's not really the case with actual marginalized people. Now, I think, you know, most of the witches just want to, like, keep to themselves and be left alone and do nice things for each other, because they're people too and they live there. But that's why it's, you know, I would be really cautious in trying to read that into a really detailed allegory of anything that exists currently, because it's not a good one.
I'm still going to call you a social justice biker witch.
That's totally fine. I'm good with that.
So say we all.
Paul, do you have any more questions for Alex?
No, I think we're at the point we're going to wrap up this interview. Thank Alex very much for bringing their debut novel and their viewpoint to the show here, and ask where we can find more from Alex, and where can we find Alex in going forward.
All right. So if you want to read more stuff I've written, all of my short stories are listed on my website, which is katsudon.net. And I've got a couple other URLs that I can't remember right now, but katsudon.net, it'll get you there. I'm on Twitter at katsudonbury. And, you know, I'm still got some short fiction that's slowly filtering into things, but I'm kind of focusing more on novels right now. So it might be a while before the next one will be like next year, but I'll be around. And I mean, I'm going to be on the Skiffy and Fanny show, so I'm really easy to find.
Exactly.
And what conventions are you going to be at this year, Alex?
So for sure, I will be at Denver Comic Con, and I will be at Helsinki World Con. I'm really, really hoping that I'll be able to make it to NASFIC, and I'm really, really hoping that maybe I'll be able to make it to Norwest Con, but I'm not going to be able to really be able to tell for another couple weeks until I find out if I'm going to get a bunch of money sucked out of me. And I'm for sure going to be at Mile High Con in Denver, because I'm there every year when I'm in Denver. And I live in Denver now. Yay!
You've escaped Tejas for Denver.
Yes. Thank goodness.
And we can find your book in all places that books are sold.
Yes, and in some brick and mortar stores, apparently, which is super exciting. And all fine bookselling establishments. And in fact, you will know that they are fine bookselling establishments because they will have my book. Otherwise, they are crap.
Indeed. So thank you so, so much for being on the show in a capacity other than reviewing bad movies or good movies and other reasons for being on the Skiffy and Fanti show.
You're welcome, citizen. You're welcome.
And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanti@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanti, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanti Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanti. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.